Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. My name is Alec. I am an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Dale for asking me to speak. And thank you all for sticking with me for the next 50 minutes or so. Good, bad, or indifferent. It'll be over soon, I promise. But I'm having a good time in sobriety. I hope I can communicate that in the next hour or so and let you know. I'm going to talk in a general way about what I was like. And if I really do it right, I'll talk about what happened, because that's really important. I've been to some meetings where we hear about what people were like and what they're like now. But the alcoholic that's suffering needs to know what happened, because people are transformed here. The power that's in Alcoholics Anonymous changes people. But I'm going to tell you, this is on the honor system, that I've been changed by Alcoholics Anonymous by going through with this process. And because I've been changed, being sober is a lot different for me now than it was in between drunks or in the early days of my sobriety. It's a lot more fun. I have a lot better time. I have many friends. I have part of a fellowship. So I'm going to try and fit all of that in there. I'm going to talk about my drinking a little bit, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And let me get to some of the basics. So, you know, in case you're crunching the numbers, my sobriety date is December 23rd, 1996. I have a home group. It's the Midtown Group of Kensington, Maryland. I have a sponsor. He's been my sponsor for over 23 years. And I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's fine for me to say that here. I got sober when I was 19 and a half, just telling somebody. So I have a certain kind of story. When I tell my story, I try not to elaborate or make it sound any tougher than it is. When I came to AA, I've been hating myself for years and feeling like a wimp and hating myself for a weakling. And then I came to AA and I'd hear people's rough and tumble stories of drinking for decades. And I'm like, man, the wimp gets sober and even his story is wimpy here in AA. And I had to decide, am I going to tell you the truth about myself, or am I going to do what we love to do, what our ego insists that we do, stretch the truth a little bit to change what you think about me? I've for the most part given up on that. I'm clear with people about what my drinking was like, how long it lasted, what brought me to AA. And there's guys that I try and focus on specifically if I think they might relate to the kind of drinking that I did as a dirtbag teenager, you know, and an almost college dropout, and, you know, and then what that was like getting sober young and what I learned from Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll try and put all that stuff in there and then tell you about how I live today. The sobriety that I enjoy today is a result of a lot of things. It's a result of the grace of a power outside of myself. It's the result of the sacrifices that a lot of people made with their time and patience and energy, especially when I was new and extra irritating. And it's a result of actions that I've taken. That might be the one that I can least take credit for, you know. But as we say, I made myself ready to receive the benefits of sobriety here. And my drinking, and I'm going to just pause so I don't lose my voice 20 minutes in here. I was destined for bigger things than Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sorry to say that to such a fine audience, but as a young man, I had a lot of potential. People often sat me down and gave me talks about my potential. And at the time, I interpreted that as them complimenting me and talking about how great I was going to be someday. What you find out in retrospect, if they're talking to you about your potential, they're disappointed. And they're not pleased. It's not encouragement. That's how somebody who hasn't given up on you yet lets you know that that's coming. And so I get these talks about my potential, and I thought, well, one of these days, I'm just going to turn it on, you know. The best day of my life before I started drinking was in seventh grade. I had won the middle school spelling bee, and my classmates carried me on their shoulders back to homeroom. And I thought, now, if people would just treat me like this every day, I'd feel normal. That's all I need. I'm not asking for much. I don't need any kind of special treatment, but the occasional daily being carried on your shoulders would be about what I need to make me feel normal. And I don't know what somebody like that gets in life if they don't discover alcohol. You know, I needed something from early on. Now, the drinking in my family, I forgot to say, I grew up in a small town in Maine, beautiful little place called Cape Elizabeth, Maine. It's picturesque. When I was growing up, we had two lighthouses and no stoplights. It's a fine place to be from. A small town. I felt like I was destined for bigger things. And my parents divorced when I was real little. That's the way I look at it now. Better to grow up in two happy houses than one miserable one. But I live with my mother. And there were, and there's not a lot of drinking on either side of my family, in my immediate family. Now, my grandparents, my dad's side, they were hardcore. I had a phantom alcoholic uncle that I barely met. He was the kind of alcoholic that would come through about once a decade when he needed money, you know, and super cool. When you're a little kid, like, those guys are cool. But I didn't see the effects of alcoholism on a day-by-day basis. My dad gave me a talk once, you know, dads, talking about his parents and what it was like growing up in an alcoholic household. And I appreciated the talk because then I knew everything I needed to know. All right, Alec, this is a plan. Make sure we don't become an alcoholic. Done, right? It's great. Perfect. You know, put that on the plan. I didn't know what I was up against. I didn't know. And nobody in my family knew what they were up against. They didn't ask for somebody like me. And they didn't have the tools for somebody like me once I started drinking. As I started to say earlier, I don't know what somebody who has a spiritual malady does if they don't discover something like alcohol. There are people out there who have all kinds of other problems that have found, you know, the people that need to go to Gamblers Anonymous have found an answer of some kind in compulsive behavior around gambling. We've got drug addicts, we've got overeaters, we've got all kinds. What I found was alcohol, and that was the thing that unlocked life for me. And so I didn't decide to do that. I was just, you know, being a troublemaker teenager, and I, you know, found alcohol and I got the magic. I got the effect. And I raided my mother's liquor cabinet because she was gone a lot. I was a latchkey kid. She traveled for work and was foolish enough to trust me and me with the household. I had an older sister, but then she went off to college. And I was home alone, and my mother had a non-alcoholic liquor cabinet. What I mean by that is there are bottles in her house today that I watered down in 1994 that haven't been touched since. But one day, you know, I don't know, one day it just occurred to me, man, there's booze in there, you know, and nobody's watching, nobody's keeping track of it. And I got the effect produced by alcohol when somebody like me, who's felt like they don't measure up their whole life, I mean, I got the nerd benefits package, good with spelling, right, you know, which does not help you get women. And so I've never been cool. I've never had cool clothes because divorced family, we couldn't afford, you know, and I was in a well-to-do town. People all had the right brands and I never did. And I found out how I feel when I drink. And so for somebody like me, when I can feel that way by raiding mom's liquor cabinet, how could I ever settle for being sober? How could I ever live with that? How could I ever wake up in the morning without that? And know what's in mom's liquor cabinet and know how I can feel if all I got to do is steal a little bit. How could I ever settle for sobriety? When I got drunk for the first time, I finally in my mind understood, so this is how I'm supposed to feel. I knew our book talks about, it describes alcoholics as being restless, irritable, and discontented. And I somewhat relate to two of those, but discontented has me to a T. I'm never content. My life's never good enough. My family situation's not good enough. I'm not good looking enough. I'm terrible at sports. I don't know how to talk to people. I have no social skills. I'm not content with my circumstances in life until I started drinking. And the version of me that showed up at those parties in the woods was something else. You know, finally content. I was good enough. People were lucky to have me around, as a matter of fact. And all I had to do was steal my mother's liquor. And so for me, if there's a line that we cross into alcoholism, I don't know, maybe it's just letting go of ever being content with sobriety. Because when I found that feeling, it created a need for itself in my life. Maybe the need was already there. I don't know. We're a whole bunch of hack job amateur psychologists. As far as I've ever gotten with alcoholic psychology is this: alcoholics do what they want. That's alcoholic psychology. We do what we want. You know, people that come in here and want an answer, we give it to them. Sure, come on in. You know, people that don't want to be sober aren't. And there's nothing we can do and nothing we can say. So I became a teenage drunk. You know how that is. It starts slow. It's progressive. I chose, you know, I threw away anything that stood between me and a drink. And I was just a nuisance, you know, in a small town. We drove around and I got sober before the era of cell phones. I try to explain this gently to the younger generation now that you could drive around all night Friday night. If you didn't find the party, you went to bed sober. And people think, man, how could you live like that? And that's how it is. Sometimes you'd meet up with other little caravans of people. Where's the party? I don't know. I've been on the whole left side of town. Let's try over here, you know. And my grades suffered. And people in my life started trying to fix problems that weren't my problem. Because for a time, I was pretty good at hiding my drinking. So we get into these like, let's fix event. Sooner or later, the meeting's about fixing you. You stop getting invited to. That's no good. Like, you know, because then they decide what the answer is. But the early problems were like, people trying to fix my grade in English. Now, as you can tell, I'm a native speaker of the English language. I should be okay in English class. So people are trying to fix my problem in English, and they're focused on the problem in English. They don't know what the real problem is. The problem is English class happens after study hall, and I can sign myself out, and we can drink under the bridge by the railroad tracks. And then when you get back into class, you know, I saved my homework the night before, because what did I always tell myself? We'll do it during study hall. And I believed it. And then study hall came around and I'm under the railroad tracks. And then my homework's not done. And some of your grade is based on participation. I'm alcoholic. I'm not stupid. I'm not going to raise my hand and say something drunk in class. So my participation grade's a zero. The work isn't done. And everybody thinks I have a problem with English. And it's not my problem. We're trying to fix the problem that isn't the problem. And because I don't tell anybody what's going on with me, nobody knows. Eventually, as you know, I don't have to give this away, the truth's going to start coming out. But in those early days, I was able to keep it together. And it was worth it. Every sacrifice I made for drinking was worth it. Because what's better than spending a study hall under the railroad tracks? You know, it's better than any education you can get. The guys that I drank with in high school were people like us, all of them. I'm convinced of it. So our lives as teenage troublemakers consisted of the same things over and over and over. Detention, suspension, expulsion, flipping cars, nights in jail, going to rehab, going to detoxes, fights with your parents, getting kicked out of your house. Hey, can I stay at your place for a while till my old man cools off? That kind of thing. That was life. And in that kind of lifestyle, in this day and age, you encounter Alcoholics Anonymous. So the guys that I drank with knew about AA as teenagers. We joke about it. Like, we're alcoholics. We're powerless. Well, I guess we better drink, you know? Why waste effort trying to do something we can't, you know? And so we joke about it. We would throw the best party ever, in case you don't know, is the your friend's going to rehab, so he has to burn through his whole stash in one night party. The second best party happens 28 days later when he gets out. The welcome home party, you know? And you end up talking about AA. And that's what I'm hearing. And I'm going back to that conversation my dad had with me. Well, thank God I know about alcoholism. I'll just make sure it doesn't happen to me. But I never tried that hard to stop. I figured it was like my potential. Whatever muscle I had to flex to stop, when the consequences get bad enough, and we're not there yet, I'll just turn it on. And for a while, that's how it was. In fact, for a while, my social life was the best it was. I had a lot of friends. I got my driver's license. I got a car. It's a great alcoholic teenager's car. Could do 0 to 60 in under a minute. You know, it's a big old diesel, and I could bounce it off of snowbanks and all that. You know, and nobody really even knew. I'll just say there was the night I was driving down the highway in the winter, and somebody poured. They emptied their bong water out the side, and it all just froze me down the side of my car because it was in Maine in the wintertime. We had to scrape it off, you know, and I was having so much fun. Monday mornings were the best. That's when everybody told the war stories, what happened that weekend. Because, you know, you leave the party, and then you're like, who made it home? Who made it home with who? Who got caught? Who got arrested? You know, and then the nicknames would come out. You know, the guy that, like, puked on his shoes, and he was getting a nickname. Monday mornings were the best. And for a while, that was my life, and the consequences weren't starting to pile up until they were. And something happened, and I can't pinpoint it, but I can only describe what happened after that loss of control somewhere. If you've ever been driving and hit black ice, you know, it doesn't matter what you do with the steering wheel. You're not in control of the car anymore. And that was what my drinking became. I made many resolutions, maybe even a decision to stop drinking. And at some point in my life, no matter what I did, I kept drinking despite the consequences. All the times that I told myself, this is the time you're going to pull it together. Look, Alec, take a couple of weeks off. Get your grades up, get people off your back. You can do it. There's a goal in sight. There is a prize, which is get out of mom's house, get to college. I've seen Animal House. It's worth it. And even when I had something worth fighting for, I couldn't do it. Now, I made it through high school. I made it off to college. But at this point, I'd been to my first AA meeting, a friend of mine who drank. Probably the only credible messenger that Alcoholics Anonymous could have sent my way, the guy who drank with me on a daily basis. So I was in the great state of Maine. He was in the Green Mountain State, Vermont. He said, I'm going to invite you to your first college party. Oh, man, I'm in, you know. And so I drove in a snowstorm across the White Mountains of New Hampshire to Burlington, Vermont. And I got there for my first college party. And my lying friend said, he goes, I didn't tell you the whole story. I'm in a sober living dorm and I'm in AA. and I think you might have a problem. Would you like to come to an AA meeting? Now, this is, the roads at that point were impassable. So he at least knew, you know, how to paint me into a corner. And I wasn't a big fan of the idea, but I was willing to go because there was, I mean, look, I'm fine with the fake personality. I think most of us are pretty good when it needs to be there. You know, everything's fine, the bombast, the bravado, you know, loud, 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 keep you at arm's length. But when he said, I think you have a problem with drinking, part of me goes, well, of course. I mean, we both know that. So he invited me to my first AA meeting and we went around the room, people introduced themselves. It was a circle discussion. And I was very clear not to admit that I was an alcoholic. I just said, my name's Alec. And we're going around because we've all met that guy. And then I start thinking, I'm like, well, what if they didn't hear me clearly? What if they thought that I said I was an alcoholic, and which was catastrophic? And sure enough, I didn't have to admit that I was an alcoholic. People came up to me afterwards. I remember very little, but it was the first time I'd seen AA's 12 steps. So this is what it was like for me. My friend had invited me to an AA meeting long before I would have sought it out for myself. I have nothing but admiration and respect for people who seek out AA on their own. A buddy of mine came to me. Again, best possible messenger that AA could have chosen. He brought me to a meeting and then he picked up a 24-hour chip for himself, tried to get me to do it. I wouldn't do it, you know. And this is who I could believe. He was credible. He was a guy who was having trouble stopping drinking. What a great messenger to send to AA. Thank God he didn't have a sponsor. I'd be dead. You know, a sponsor would have said, don't hang out with your old drinking buddies. You got nothing to offer. But he just decided it was a good idea to call me up and lie to me about college parties. I don't know, that's not a book, but I owe my life to that guy. And so I'm sitting in this meeting and I read through and I know there's something going on with my drinking. I don't know what it is. I know one day I'm gonna unleash my potential and take care of it. For right now, things are really bad. And despite consequences, I'm just a disappointment factory to everybody around me. And I see this word powerless and I've never considered that. I mean, who would think of that? You know, I'm probably not an alcoholic. I probably feel things very deeply. I would admit to that, right? You know, oh, very emotionally sensitive. My life is like, you know, it needs a soundtrack. To me, the level of drama in my life, just, you know, but I'm probably not an alcoholic. And then I see this word powerless. What if that's it? What if that's really the problem? That my dilemma is not that I'm drunk every day, because I couldn't be. I was at that point, 17, 18. I couldn't drink every day. That's not my problem. Drunk all the time. It's not my problem. But what if that's it? What if it's lack of power? What if that's really what's wrong? What if that makes me like that phantom uncle that I have, my dad's parents? I've heard all the stories. And for a moment, for as long as it takes to go from step one to step two, maybe, I had a taste of what we hope people get when they walk in the door, which is, these people understand how I feel. A little taste of that. I was ready to shut you out, keep you at arm's length, but there was a chance that you might understand how I feel. And I got to the second step and everything came crashing down because I saw your power greater than myself, your sneaky little capital P in there, right? We're in the basement of a church and I can put two and two together. And the disappointment was, honestly, it was awful. And I, you know, I like to joke around and kind of be over dramatic, but really the idea of that moment where I thought maybe this is a place where somebody like me could go. And then I just thought, oh, well, this is some kind of church thing. And I just thought I'm ineligible. I'm disqualified. Somebody like me is not interested in this. Whatever you got, it's just not going to work for me. It was really too bad. It's like being like kicked out of a clinical trial for like a real health problem. You know, I thought people here are doing well. My friend who invited me to that first meeting taught me how to get into AA, right? He taught me how to find AA. I didn't know. I thought it was like a secret society. He told me, no, there's a men's meeting every day at noon. He told me some of the basics. He said, no, you don't have to sign up for anything. You don't have to put money in the basket if you don't want to. You can actually take the coffee without putting money in the basket, which is great. And he taught me how to get a free big book, which I will pass on to you. He said, in Portland, Maine, there's a central office where they sell literature. I'm going to tell you a little trick. You go in the office. This is all you have to do. You ask them how much a big book costs. And then when they tell you, you just look sad. And if you don't say anything for long enough, they will give you a big book. Works. Absolutely works. That's how I got my first big book. It was a hand-me-down from the central office. And in fact, 20 years later, I went back and paid for it with some interest there. But he told me how to find AA. He told me I didn't need to be physically sober, which I didn't know that. I thought, man, it was nice to know, because most of my windows of willingness were not when I was sober. It was when I was a little drunk and really miserable. And he let me know that I could go to AA in any condition as long as it didn't disturb the meeting. So he taught me what a guy who's not ready to stop drinking needs to know about stopping drinking. That if you're willing to be willing, there is an answer. And so I proceeded to be the drunk occasional attendee of the High Noon men's group in Portland, Maine. Swing by when things were bad a couple times over the course of the next year. And the group carried a message. Now, as burnt out as I was, it was very hard for me to hear what people were saying. But there was a message in the group. And the message that was conveyed to me was exactly this. The same men were there regularly, and they were still sober. Nobody had to raise their hand and explain it. I observed that. So as a drunk, I came in and I heard the laughter before the meeting. When the meeting would start, people would settle down. And I go, oh, he's the guy that was here last time. He's still sober. He was here last time. He's the one that talked about throwing up a margarita. I loved that. I loved his story about throwing up the margarita. Okay. All right. Well, if it ever gets bad enough, at least I know there's a place where those people can go. It's too bad I'm not like one of them. And the remainder of my drinking consisted of grinding down my ego's feelings of being different. All those, you don't understand. I'm obviously much more sensitive than all you people. Something like this will never work for me. I bring a lot of prejudice against organized religion. I bring a lot of overthinking here. But it's nice to know that there's a place where people can go. And if I had known of anything else other than AA, that's where I would have ended up. I just didn't know. And I came to AA a couple times toward the end. One night, a tough night. I found a meeting in the directory. I don't know if you ever had this experience. I went there and the directory was out of date. There was no meeting. It was an awful night. I don't want to downplay it. It was an awful, awful night. It was as bad as it ever got for me going back to AA. And I went to an empty church, which was pretty terrible. And if I get time, I'll talk about this later, my involvement with intergroup and trying to make sure that happens as little as possible. I was able to try and balance out the world just a little bit for somebody else like me. I made it off to college. It was a disaster. People like me get to drink as much as they want. You know how that goes. I mean, I'm on the getting kicked out of college track, but my sobriety date's December 23rd. So I made it through one semester. That's it. I came home lying the whole time. Somewhere in there, I went, oh, biggest mistake ever. Never sit your parents down and admit that you might possibly have a little problem with drinking, because the next day when you've moved on, they haven't. They're still with them and they're making appointments for you. And I saw some alcoholism counselor, very nice guy, very easy to pull a fast one on. Although in retrospect, he might've known a little bit what was going on. So we talked about Alec going off to college. He said, well, let's find out. He gave me a very scientific answer. Can you stop drinking? That's a fair question. I said, I'm pretty sure I can. And he said, well, let's do a trial. Why don't you go to college, but don't drink for a while? And then call me and we'll check in. We'll see how it goes. We'll see if you can do it. Like, challenge accepted. He said, all right, well, let's do this trial period. Now, he leaned forward very interested. He said, how long should this trial period be held? And I wanted him to know that I meant business. I said, I'm going to give it 2 weeks. And he laughed. He said, I was thinking more like a semester or a year. And I'm a pretty good negotiator. I got him down to a month. I'm not going to spend all my parents' money on college and not drink. I mean, hello, I've been waiting years for this. So I made it 3 hours after my mother's station wagon pulled away, but I called the man in a month to tell him how well my first month of sobriety was going, and I didn't need a follow-up appointment. So this is how it is. And when I was drinking, again, the pre-cell phone days, my parents would try and check in with me. I'd get a call from them. It would wake me up. The alarm clock would say 7 something, and it's like half light. Now, is it 7 something Saturday morning? Is it Saturday evening? Is it Sunday morning? Is it Monday morning? I have no idea. The first thing they ask, how was your weekend? It was good. I did a lot of studying. That's it. I don't even need to think about that. So I'm lying. Here's what's funny now in sobriety. Occasionally, from time to time, I'll have dreams where I'm drinking. It's not good. It happens. Every single time, I don't think I've ever once dreamed about taking my first drink. In every dream, I've been drinking and I've been lying about it. For me, that way of life. And nobody had to sit me down and explain that. Nothing I was doing was worth being honest about anyway. Why would I tell somebody the truth? I mean, I knew early on, tell people what you're doing. And so I'm drinking, I'm lying. I'm in and out of AA meetings. I've never been an AA member. I've been a drunken big book owner. I go to the parties and then I'd freak out. I'd have my freak outs and I'd go back to my room. Sometimes I'd read the big book drunk. That's awesome. Like, you're living your best life when you're drunk reading the big book, trying to figure that out. I had it backwards on my bookshelf. So the guy who brings his AA big book to college in case he catches alcoholism is in a bad way. I don't mean to spoil it for you. And this was to be the end of my drinking. And I came home. I drank by the railroad tracks with my buddies. December 22nd. The next day, I get home. I drink a bunch of cough syrup, top shelf stuff. And the next morning, I wake up. The room's still moving around. But I go over to my men's meeting. By the end of that hour, I'm sober. And that was to be my sobriety date. And so for years, I would tell that story and I would say, you know, it was Monday, like any other, like any of the other times, like anyway, it was a cruddy, you know, Christmas was coming. I don't have any money left over to buy presents for anybody. The grades that I'd been lying about were going to come in the mail. Like, you know, that feeling when you're lying, even though you know you're going to get caught, you know, just to keep it going. And the grades were coming and they weren't good. And I was going to get kicked out of school. And, I went to the men's meeting. For years, I told that story. And it was just another crappy day. These things were, you know, bad enough that I would go to AA. And I don't think that does justice to our program, because it's not really arbitrary like that. It's not like sometimes people get sober, sometimes they don't. I had to look clearly to be able to tell that story because something was different. The results were different. So something must have been different. The result is many, many years of sobriety. So what changed? What changed is shortly thereafter, not right away, but within a couple weeks, and I was pretty good for a couple weeks of sobriety on my own, not to brag. I mean, I can quit drinking with the best of them quantity, not quality. Right? I swore off drinking a lot, but somebody introduced me to a young guy at an AA meeting. Never met a young guy. And I asked him to be my sponsor immediately. And that's what was different. So I was on the hold your breath for a little while plan. That had always been the same. Feel bad, go to AA, hold your breath, withdraw from the world. Total isolation is pretty good for sobriety temporarily. But I asked somebody to be my sponsor. That was the first time I had taken an action in AA. Now there's all kinds of things that AA members do, but I had done none of them whatsoever except scam a big book. And for the first time, I did a thing for my sobriety. I asked the guy to be my sponsor. I did no vetting of his qualifications, asked for his resume or his credentials. The guy could have been a murderer. But for the first time, it wasn't just me versus alcoholism. And for the rest of my sobriety, that's been a common threat. Alcoholism is too much for one person. I heard that from Alan. You're outnumbered. No one person can stand up to alcoholism, whether it's the alcoholic or somebody who loves it. There's nothing, completely alcoholic. But when alcoholics get together, we become a power greater than ourselves. And the lack of power, that was my dilemma, finally has some ground to stand on. And I became introduced to the power here. So I'm gonna pause and take a sip of water and get into talking about my sobriety. Now, I'll do a little diversion into AA history. The pandemic was really good for that. A lot of reading about AA history. I had some spare time on my hands. But fun fact, nobody invented Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't know if you know that. Nobody sat down and said, we got too many alcoholics here. We need a thing for them. We need a thing. AA emerged, sobriety emerged as a side effect of people who were members of people who took their alcoholism problem into a religious organization. Don't want to scare anybody away. We had to split with it. AA is not a religious organization. But the earliest AA members back in the 1930s found a religious movement of the Oxford groups of the day. They brought their alcoholic problems in. And they found through a process that the Oxford group people practice, one of the results was sobriety. Now, a couple decades ago, some chemists were working on a blood pressure drug. They found a side effect, and now we have Viagra, right? So it's the same kind of thing. A bunch of alcoholics brought their problems into the Oxford groups. And some of the tenets or the principles of the Oxford group had nothing to do with sobriety. I don't want you to get confused. Again, sobriety, unexpected side effect. But the people who were doing this Oxford group plan were convinced that in order to have a relationship with their higher power, they had to be completely free of resentment. They had to make amends for harms that they had done. They had to share freely about their defects. And they had to go out and tell other people about this way of life. And the non-alcoholics who were doing that were experiencing a newfound relationship with their creator. And they're feeling good. And they wanted to let people know about it. And they had very, very high standards for, again, honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. They had a code by which they lived. And they spent a lot of time in prayer and meditation. One of the most important principles they had was spend quiet time in the morning to try and get guidance and direction from God. And so troubled people hearing about good results in their lives would come to the Oxford group. And for a while, I had known a little bit about our co-founder, Bill Wilson, how a message was carried to him through some Oxford group members, that drunks that he had known when he was younger. And it culminated with him meeting Dr. Bob in Akron. But there was another piece that I didn't know about, which was that there was another alcoholic, Bud Firestone, of the famous Firestone tire family, was a rich drunk, which I'd love, you know, not a bad gig if you can get it, you know, do a lot of drinking, like your rich parents pay for it. He had been introduced to the Oxford group as well on a train ride home from Colorado. His family had done an intervention. They didn't know what to do with a drunk. There's no way to fix drugs. And they introduced him to the Oxford group as well, you know, the power of God, give him the power of God, put him in a spiritual movement. And Bud Firestone was able to get sobriety temporarily. He brought that to the town of Akron, Ohio. And he shared, he was from a rich family. We don't really have classes. We don't really have an upper class like they had 100 years ago. But back then, the few really rich people had a certain code. And one of the things is you never talk about your problems. It's very much how you appear in the community. You're very rich. You never show weakness. You never show problems at home. You never talk about it. And Bud Firestone's family used the Oxford group to go out and testify, and they talked about his drinking. So in the city of Akron, Ohio, of all places, there was a community of people who understood that the kind of alcoholism that people usually don't talk about has an answer. And these people need to be in these Oxford groups. And in fact, our co-founder, Dr. Bob, was in an Oxford group, but he never told the truth about himself. He was a crummy member. He was like me in my early days of AA. He came, he didn't work their program. He didn't tell them the truth. He didn't share. And boy, I relate to that. And he didn't stop drinking. And the members of his group, in fact, one of the busybodies, Henrietta Cyberling of the Cyberling family, which is behind Goodyear Rubber. So she related to the Firestone. She had all this money. She was estranged from her husband. It's a big deal. He was living in the 60,000 square foot mansion. And she was living in the gatehouse with the kids. But they couldn't talk about that until she went to her Oxford group and she could share about problems at home. And she heard the Firestone people talk about how Bud Firestone had stopped drinking when he embraced this spiritual program. And she decided to do a number on Dr. Bob. Now, there was no AA. There was no AA, but she believed in the power of God. And she arranged, she would have been a great Al-Anon. She got everybody in the group to confront Dr. Bob in the April Oxford group meeting. And say, Bob, she got everybody. She goes, I want everybody to put their worst stuff in the middle. Give me your worst dirty laundry. And then we're going to get to Bob. We're going to see if we can get him to talk. And they did that. And they broke him. And he talked about his drinking problem for the first time. And he asked the people in his group to pray for him. And that was the month of April, 1935. And within a couple of weeks, Bill Wilson, through a series of circumstances, ended up on the phone with Henrietta Cyberling saying, I'm a member of an Oxford group in New York, far out of town, but I do have a way to fix alcoholics. Any chance you know any? It was within a month. She's like, what took you so long? I've been praying for weeks here, you know. she put him in touch with Dr. Bob. Now, all of that is to say, this is before there was an AA. There was no Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I'm going to start a fight here. I'm going to say the first AA meeting didn't happen until after our book was published. Because when the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written, it described people with alcoholism who were members of Oxford groups working a program. We didn't have our 12 steps yet until How It Works was written. They were doing certain things, and the result of that was their sobriety. And they woke up feeling a little different. And when we published a big book, some of the guys in Cleveland, they were tired of driving down to Akron, but a lot of them were Catholic. And the Catholic Church had a very strong stance against the Oxford group spiritual movement. They said, you can't be a Catholic and do this. Confession that they do. You can't be in an Oxford group with Oxford group members. And when I read the big book, knowing what I've read in the last couple of years about the Oxford group's program, about their belief in guidance, dependence on a higher power, the importance of cleaning up your past, making amends, being free of fear and resentment, carrying the message to others. But again, prayer, meditation, spiritual guidance from God. When I know about that Oxford group program and I read the big book, I think back to high school when I had to write a paper without plagiarizing. How many words do you have to change so that it's your own? And that's what these early AA members were doing. They were describing what it was like to be an alcoholic and find sobriety in an Oxford movement, but they could never call it that by name. So in May of 1939, the folks in Cleveland had a meeting that was only for alcoholics. They asked the old timers, most of them thought it was a really bad idea. I mean, can you imagine just a room full of drunks with no non-alcoholics to keep us on the straight and narrow? But as we know, it was a radical success and became the basis for our meetings. So I read about that Oxford group and I hear about people in groups or members of groups who have meetings, who share and work with others. And I know where we came from. Now we had to split from that. Let's be very clear. And Bill Wilson wrote a great article he wrote about that. There's a dozen or more reasons why we had to split. Not the least of which is part of the Oxford group consisted of sitting and listening for guidance from God and then going out and doing it. And occasionally you would check with somebody else and it's like, well, can you imagine a whole bunch of people who are alcoholics getting into arguments about what God's plan is for me today? You know, if I'm sure this is what God wants for me today and you're telling me no, well, who are you to discredit what God himself has told me to do today? You know, and that sort of thing worked just fine for more even keeled non-alcoholics. We had to get away from that. Now that stuff is still in our book. If you want to know how I live today, take a look at my morning. I have a quiet time in the morning. I make my coffee. I sit. I have a beautiful woods behind my house. I have a spot where I sit and I look out at the trees. It's very peaceful. And I try to come up with a plan for the day that's not ruled by selfishness. Now, to be very clear, I do not get instructions from God. I don't think that's a part of our program. But I look for an intuitive thought. And I look for how can I be of service to my family, to my group, to the men I sponsor, and to the alcoholics in my community. I don't have to think about my job because I'm greedy and I think about that all the time. So this is a one time for not thinking about my day, how am I going to build my empire. All of those things require self-sacrifice. They require me to give up my time. And I spend time in the morning. Now I don't call my sponsor. And I just think, you know, I think is there maybe somebody that shared something in a meeting who's going through a tough time and I haven't talked to, or maybe what about like somebody that I just haven't seen for a while? Or maybe a name pops in my head for no reason. I don't think anybody's really going to get too upset with me if that's my guidance from God for today. It's like calling a friend that I haven't talked to in a while. I feel like that's pretty safe. I don't make major life plans based on these spur of the moment things. But if I'm thinking about my day and what I can do for others, that's a pretty good thing. So I can trace that all the way back to those Oxford group people who had no interest in helping alcoholics. It was a side benefit. But why is that important? Why should somebody like me embrace that as a way of life? I'll give you my opinion. You know, the book talks about it, true. I'll try and back it up if I can. What you should know, left hand, put the drink over there, is that when I was drinking, I woke up needing a drink. Like, you know, if somebody asked, how are you this morning? The true answer is, I need a drink. The way that I'm living, I need a drink. I'm thinking about all the areas where my scorecard's in trouble, the wreckage I've caused, the flaws in my relationship, the difficulties I have with authority figures, the lies I've told and been, the ones I've been caught for, and the ones I haven't been caught yet, but I know it's coming. And the self-centeredness, the painful self-centeredness and uniqueness. And I need to address that. I've recovered from alcoholism. What hasn't changed is there's a part of me that'll never forget what a drink will do for me. That's never going to be lost on me. That's always going to be there somewhere, that knowledge that no matter what, there's some measure of relief in a drink. And we do pretty good at putting that way, way, way on the back burner. But what AA offered me is a way of living that actually smoothed out those disturbances. It took out, just like those Oxford group guys wanted, I cleaned up the wreckage of my past. so I can like answer the phone and open the mail and talk to people in my family. I have a way to address fears and resentments. I went through an inventory with my sponsor on some of the bigger resentments, but I'll tell you, I have the same capability to get those over and over and over. But it was important for me to do it with a sponsor. And here's an example. I'm going to share something from a scandalous thing from my first step, not really. The second day of first grade, teacher gives us a coloring assignment. When it's done, she holds up a picture to show the class. It wasn't mine. It was Tommy Forrest's picture in first grade. And I was mad at Tommy Forrest for about 17 years after that, right? And I had to talk about that with my sponsor, you know, it's a young man, you know, still hanging on to first grade. And we got through that. Turns out it was actually not worth being mad at Tommy for that one, you know. But I'll tell you, here's what I uncovered that day that I still have with me. It makes me nuts when other people succeed. What is that? Is there a limit to the amount of success in the world? Does your happiness mean that there's less happiness for me? What is that? But in that process with my sponsor, I got to understand patterns that I still see today. I do it in my job. I'm in a competitive, very competitive industry in sales. I love it. It's great for me. It appeals to my basest instincts. But every once in a while, the guys I work with do something great and I'm furious. I'm livid. And I have to think about Tommy freaking Forrest in first grade. And they've gone out, they've done something great with an account that isn't even mine. There's nothing I can do there. It has nothing to do with me. The company's doing great. They're doing great. And I'm smoldering. And I got to let that stuff go. Why? Is it because I'm going to drink over it today? No. But those things start to add up. And that's part of a way of life. And that way of life builds a wall between me and that guy. You know, next time I see him, I say something smart to him. He has no idea why. Like, what's this hostility from Alec, right? I use the inventory process to look at my fears because I was trapped by my fears. You come to AA and people say, like, by the end of my drinking, I couldn't even look at myself in the mirror. And I'm like, I felt like that since fourth grade. I hated that guy. I hated what I saw in there. I hated my weakness. I hated how afraid I was. I hated that I never felt tough enough. And anytime I do get in a conflict or a confrontation with somebody, my pulse goes crazy. My voice shakes. I mean, I look like an idiot. There's nothing tough about me in a conflict. I'm awful at it. And I hate myself for it. So what's that like? I'm convinced that I'm going to fail in life. I'm convinced that's some critical John Wayne skill that I need to succeed. In fact, I've been doing just fine without it. I still get that way. I still am awful in conflict. I'm really good at conflict when I'm in the shower by myself, imagining I win every single argument that I have. But let's look at that way of life. How do I feel when that's done? My day hasn't even started and I'm all adrenaline. So this, what I'm talking about, is about A's design for living that is intended to set aside those fears, those resentments, the anger, the shame that I would burn with, especially when I got caught, and my inability to reach out to people. People know when you're lying. People know, I think. I was always pretty impressed with my ability to maintain three or more separate personalities, but I think people can see through it, especially here. The funny thing about AA is the two currencies that we exchange here are our time and the truth about ourselves. And people can tell when you've got an angle and you're trying to get something out of them. But my goal, as I said in the beginning, is for somebody to walk through the door and to have the feeling, there's no word for it, but the way I describe it is, these people understand how I feel. I think without that, there's nothing we can do for an alcoholic, because I've been the guy who's in the meeting stealing your coffee, basically thinking that there's nothing these people can do for me. They don't understand. But it took my drinking to wear down those feelings of uniqueness and difference. That's all ego. And so I had to go through the ego reducing process of our steps, the inventory, learning to tell the truth about myself, being honest with another human being, being completely honest with my sponsor, who today knows everything about me. He knows all the crummy stuff that I've done drinking and in sobriety. He's clear on that. Going out and clearing away the wreckage of my past. For me, it was mostly family. This guy I stole a car from, but that was the easiest one to make amends. He just wanted money. So easy. And I had to make formal amends with my family. I'd sit down with my parents, my sister, talk about what a disappointment I'd been, talk about some of the things I'd stolen from them, and ask them, what could I do to make it right? So when I take guys through the steps and we get to writing out the eight step, I pretty much let people off the hook. Like, look, you don't need to write down how to make this right, because you've never made anything right in your life. If you're like me, you've never cleaned up a mess. You've always let other people take care of it. So you don't need to get an A plus in figuring out how to fix these relationships. Ask the people you've harmed. They'll tell you. They'll tell you what's important. They'll let you know. And that's a tough conversation to have. I owed my dad a bunch of money. I wrote him a check. My sponsor said I was in a position to write one check and take care of it all. And I mailed it to him. I didn't even say it was coming. Just wrote it to him. This is what it's for. And he called me. And I remember exactly where I was for this conversation. I was coming home from work. I was on a cell phone, walking into the house. He said, Alec, I got this check from you in the mail. I knew which one he was talking about. And he said, you know, I have some beliefs about parenting. One of my beliefs is our children do not borrow money from us. When we give them money, it's a gift. We don't take it back. And I could almost feel the money coming back into my bank account. He said, but if it's for your sobriety, I'm going to cash this check. Curse that man in his integrity. He wanted the best for me, and he knew there's no cutting corners. I got a few minutes left, maybe less than 10 minutes left. And I want to talk about AA has a design for living. When we talk about being in AA, really we're talking about the step. There's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which probably saved my life. Before I was interested in your program or your book, I just needed someplace to be with people that weren't drinking. That was the beginning. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous kept me on life support to be around people that weren't drinking. And they let me know that my old friends weren't bad people, but that I probably need to put a little space in there. And without the fellowship of drinking, there was going to be a hole in my social life that you could drive a truck through. Somebody like me needed an answer for what to do on Friday and Saturday night, especially as a young single guy. I needed the fellowship of AA. I hadn't worked a step, drank a lot of coffee, smoked a lot of cigarettes, but the time was filled. So I wasn't sitting around thinking about what my old friends were doing. That was really important. Eventually, that was filled up by the program of AA. When we talk about somebody doing AA, we're not talking about doing the fellowship. Although the fellowship is incredibly important, it's important for me to invest time in that. But we're talking about going through a process that changes us. And as I said in the beginning, I've been changed. Let's see if I can find this. I should have bookmarked it. Get that, it fell open. You can tell I've maybe used this once or twice before. It fell open to the page. The chain of events led to Bill Wilson getting this message came through Dr. Carl Jung, and he talked about people that he had seen stop drinking, because people do stop drinking. We're pretty pleased with ourselves that people come here and stop drinking. People do stop drinking without AA. And he talked about, Dr. Jung talked about what had to happen. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena, not normal. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. And here's how he describes it. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which once were the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. So if I had to summarize my sobriety in one sentence, I'd say this. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding force of the life of this man, were slowly, painfully slowly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives began to dominate. So my values have changed as a result of time that I've spent in AA and sacrifices that I've made and service that I've done and prayers that I've prayed. Slowly, without anything that I can pinpoint, my values have changed. So it's one thing for me to tell you that. But as you know how the world works, I don't need to tell you. If you want to know what I believe, just watch what I do. We don't have time to do that tonight. But here's what you would see if you followed me around. You would see a man who makes time for prayer and meditation. I am a person who prays. I'm not good at it. I can't explain it. I get something out of it. I 20 plus years of sobriety. It was pretty sweet. But I'm a person who makes time for prayer and meditation. That should tell you something about my values. I make time to do service in AA. I have service at my home group. I do. I was a drunken roadie. So now I'm like the AA PA guy. You know, I do the speakers and stuff and Zoom, and I helped out with that. I sacrifice my time for that. I sacrifice my time for the guys that I sponsor. Here's the trick. When they call, you are allowed to sigh as long as you do it before you answer the phone, because they never call when it's a good time for me. I'm always in the middle of something that's Alec oriented, and they interrupt it every time, and they're chatty. I give a big sigh. Don't tell, by the way. Don't tell anybody I sponsor me. Because they're interrupted yours truly. Hey, how you doing, man? You know. You want to know what I believe? Watch what I do. I make time. So here's the thing. This is the problem today, after over 20 years of sobriety. When I wake up in the morning, my first thought, if I had to do my first thought, my plan for the day, if I consider my plan for the day, here's what I would come up with. I absolutely believe that you are important and I need to make time for you. Unfortunately, I have reviewed my day and today's not your day, because today is full. When you look at what I need and what I want and what I'm afraid I'm not going to get and what I'm afraid I'm going to lose, unfortunately, it's going to take every waking moment for me to manage all that. I promise you're next in line. My intentions are good. I promise you're next. And I need that time in the morning to rearrange that. Didn't he use that word? Rearrangement? You know? I need a rearrangement of my values. Not always joyfully, but I do believe that my life is on the line. And the danger is insidious. And this is what I've seen after a lot of years in AA. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. It's a dirty secret. Do you know what happens when you miss a meeting? Nothing. Nothing happens. I have missed a meeting and nothing happened. And what does that lead to? Well, it means missing another meeting and nothing happens. A whole lot of nothing happens. All of a sudden you start getting your laundry done. It's great. They're pleased with you at work, your family that loves you. The threat, one of the threats of long-term sobriety is cutting back and not having anything happen. But it's out there somewhere. That pile starts to grow. I went through a phase, 14, 15 years sober. I was a dad. It was a lot of things. Husband, was a dad, was a valued worker on a team. Everybody's waiting, you know, but all eyes on me, you know, no skating through this one. I had a lawn that needed mowing. I lived between two retired guys. I mean, the pressure was intense. And I'm traveling for work. My employer gets the most out of me when I work a full day and then fly at night. That works really good. If you give blood, they'll take it. And what was being sacrificed was the time at meetings. I was traveling. I wasn't able to do service. And this isn't a drinking, you know, I drank story. Although we've heard that story a lot. The story is I was sitting with a guy that I loved, one of my coworkers, drinking a beer, he was having a beer. And I thought, man, there was a time when this kind of thing used to freak me out. And I don't know if I'm getting better or if I'm really in danger. And I don't know. And I can't tell you, honestly, hook me up to a lie detector. I don't know where I am. I don't know if my next drink is an hour away or if I could keep doing this for another year. I don't know. And I'd always counted on knowing. All those years that I'd sat in meetings, we hear the story. Life got good. I drifted and then I drank. This is just like the pep talk from my dad. I filed that away. I said, well, I'll just make sure if I start to drift that I come back. Great plan if you have power. If lack of power is not your dilemma, that's a great plan. Drift, come back. Drift, come back. You know, one of my friends says, if I knew how many meetings I could miss before I drank, that's how many I'd miss minus one, you know? But I don't know. And I got in a scary spot. So what do? When you're scared, I reached out for help. And this, I said, this isn't a I drank story. This is I got to see with crystal clarity that I don't have the power of choice even today, and that this stuff is insidious and that it sneaks up on you. All those people who had told that story, maybe they talked about it in this way, but I never heard them say, you don't see it coming. Nobody chooses to back off AA. They choose to do the right thing. Show up for their family, pay their bills, be a taxpayer, do all that stuff. You know, I'm not even enjoying this. This is sacrifice. Why is everybody mad at me? You know? And I had to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I reached out to my friends. I asked for help. I talked to a couple of guys I got sober with and said, hey, keep an extra close eye on me. One of my friends, this is 10 years ago, one of my friends still calls me like four times a week because of that conversation. So I've been loved. I've been cared for. But I've been held to a high standard of integrity, honesty, and sacrifice. I like being in AA. I enjoy the time that I spend here. I love the beautiful laughter here. The people that are completely unhinged are my people. You know, we tell you we're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well, but there's plenty of bad people here. You know, I mean, if that makes you feel good, if you're relieved to hear that you're not bad, you might actually be bad, you know? And that's how I was. I was a bad person. I was selfish and destructive. I was a bad person that needed to get my act together. I needed to start acting like a good person. and a completely new set of motives began to dominate me. So now I think about my day, I think about what I can get. Not always, but occasionally. Enough is in there, but there's an opening for the grace of God. So there's a power here. There's a solution for alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's available to anybody. And I thank you for being a part of my sobriety and for giving me access to what you have. It's the most glorious journey I've ever been on. My heart is light as a result of my friendships here. And I hope and pray that this solution is always here for those to come after. So thank you all for listening.